Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to return to a topic that we deal with quite a little, and that is water. You know, I know water, you add it to whiskey for making a potable drink, but of course it's used in agriculture, it's used all over. We all know about water. But there's one person who's in the studio today. His name is Brad Udall. He's a senior water and climate research scientist and scholar at Colorado State University. And he is an expert on water use, obviously, and all the aspects of water, especially concentrating on the western United States. So, Brad, welcome to Science Studio.
Keith, thanks. Pleasure to be here. My wife jokes that three words in that title are actually true: water, climate, and unfortunately, senior. Forget
about the scholar.
Scientist and scholar part.
I mean, the implication to that is, I mean, this is off the target, so to speak, but, you know, scientists are scholars by definition. They should be, you know, I suppose.
Well, you know academia. I mean, titles are important, right?
Absolutely. Oh, being an Englishman, I know titles are very important. Pay you nothing but give you an OBE or a CBE or a Sir at the end of your career and you go home
so
happy.
That scholar's worth a lot of money.
Absolutely. Well, let's get on to before you became a scholar, you were a kid, right? And,
yep.
And how did you go from being a young boy to being in charge of a water institute and this wonderful title?
You know, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and water there, just like here, is very precious. As a kid, lived in this desert. At the age of 15, my mother took me down the Grand Canyon, and it's a two-week trip. It was an incredible trip, and I decided I wanted to be a Grand Canyon boatman, and by gosh, I did. Throughout college, I did 45 trips in the Grand Canyon. I have 2 years of my life on the Colorado River, and that river is the river I now study. Seven states it supplies water, two nations, 40 million people, almost 5 million acres of irrigated ag. It's the lifeblood of the American Southwest, and it's sort of funny that in some ways it all traces back to that trip on the Colorado River I took. And there's actually even a little better story that goes along with this, which is the Colorado River was divided in 1922 amongst the seven states in a document called the Colorado River Compact. And there's a dividing line in that compact between the upper basin, four states, and the lower basin, three states, in a place called Lee's Ferry. It's where you begin these Grand Canyon River trips. It's now operated by the National Park Service right below Glen Canyon Dam. Turns out my great-great-grandfather was John D. Lee, for whom Lee's Ferry was named. Lee was a Mormon. He was sent there by Brigham Young to avoid prosecution for a crime that he and others had committed in southern Utah.
To do with wives?
No, it dealt with a wagon train of non-Mormons who were on their way to California. And Lee and his compatriots actually murdered a bunch of these folks. So Brigham Young sent Lee there to hide, to establish this ferry and to hide. Lee had 21 wives and now has something like 800.
It's not easy to hide if you've got 21 wives.
Well, he would actually move from wife to wife, actually, on the lamb. But, I mean, the fun part of the Udall family history is that Udalls are Lees. And so that's part of my history, too, is the fact that this river I study and perhaps the most important point on it from a policy point is my named after my great-great-grandfather.
So Udall, I mean, that strikes a memory in my head about Arizona and
sure.
Politicians.
Yeah. Same family. I'm the son of Morris Mo Udall, who served for 30 years in Congress, and his brother was Stuart Udall. And Stuart's full name is Stuart Lee Udall. And
right.
My sister's name is Catherine Lee Udall. And even just to throw a little more politics in here, Mike Lee, Tea Party senator from Utah, is also a descendant of John D. Lee, as you might assume.
Okay. So, I mean, you're on a separate topic completely, but you are a Mormon then?
No, I'm not a Mormon. Oh. And I'm as far away from Mike Lee's politics as you might
okay.
imagine. So
okay.
It's just the breadth of the breadth of history here that's kind of fun to touch on.
It's lovely, actually, to be able to trace back. And then the change in attitudes that people in your family have had towards, say, the environment.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I first came to America, the Udall was a name I knew. I think they were Democrats,
yeah.
And they would sort of – they got into the environment. But they weren't always that way.
No, they weren't. And, you know, in the early 1960s, both my father and my uncle – my father was in Congress. My uncle was Secretary of the Interior under President Kennedy at the time. wanted to promote dams in the Grand Canyon, of all places, to supply water to Arizona. And they quickly were disabused of this notion by David Brower of the Sierra Club. And there were legendary battles that you can read about now. And both my father and my uncle got new wisdom and religion. I think my father at one point said, early on, he said, I may not see the light, but I certainly feel the heat. And later he saw the light and became well known as an environmentalist and really good person on these issues. But he started off kind of on the wrong side. He and Stuart grew up on this little tiny farm in northern Arizona where water was precious and dams were good at the time. And we just frankly didn't know very much.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the tremendous advances of the Internet, that you can – in the old times, and that's by old times, 40 years ago, you could look at your local environment and see what made common sense to you based upon what you could see without seeing a bigger picture. And the bigger the picture becomes, then the more informed you are, and then decisions become, in theory, better arrived at, better decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I mean, we've grown from a billion people in 100 years ago to 7.5 billion. We're headed to 9 billion. All of a sudden, the calculus on everything changes.
Well, of course, there are people who think that's the major problem. Climate change, yeah. That's real. What the reasons are, not everybody agrees. But everybody can see that the exponential growth in people is an issue that we have to deal with at some stage.
And
it'll
water.
Deal with itself automatically.
Yeah.
Right.
Water. I mean, this is many of the water problems is a people problem in some way.
After having a childhood and a young adulthood going up and down the river there, when did you decide to go to college and what did you want to study?
You know, I ended up studying engineering. I had no idea I was going to study engineering, but as a kid, I loved learning how things worked, you know, mechanical, technological things. Used to take things apart and put them back together. And I still have that knack, right? And I ended up becoming an engineer. At the time, environmental engineering was not something that was well known. I made environmental engineering program at Stanford when I did my undergraduate there and studied water and transportation. Renewable energy at the time was a hot topic. And those were things I was interested in and wanted to learn more about and work in. So that's what I did as an undergraduate.
Let's talk about the position. You're now the senior water and climate research scientist and scholar, Colorado State University, at a specific institute to deal with water.
So
Tell us about that.
I'm at the Colorado Water Institute. Every state in the nation has one of these institutes. They're funded by the U.S. Geological Survey. They're oftentimes at land-grant institutions. The funding is not huge. I work with the director there, and this institute works on basically all aspects of water, many of which are associated with agriculture because agriculture uses about 80% of water in the West. And we fund research. We fund students. We publish a newsletter. We do a whole bunch of things that both educate the public and educate students about water issues.
I mean, is it also some service to the agricultural community, how best to utilize their water resources?
Absolutely. Yep. For example, right now, one of the things we're very interested in is efficiency. You know, how can you make water use as efficient as possible in agriculture, given that it uses 80%? And you know, on farm, can you – and everybody knows these efficiency measures from, you know, trying to move to sprinklers, the lining canals, the laser leveling fields, in some cases planting different crops, maybe even deficit irrigating these crops, not giving them their full water supply. But trying
tell us a little bit of that. That's something I know nothing about.
Yeah.
I mean, so lining canals I understand, but what's deficit watering?
So – deficit irrigation is the idea. In some ways, you're trying to get something for nothing, frankly. And it doesn't fully work with biological systems, but you can play around and get some gain out of it. So, for example, some crops are very sensitive at certain stages of their life cycles to needing lots of water, and in other stages, they're not so sensitive. So maybe you give them less water than they need at certain times, but when, for example, with a crop that produces grain, when they're filling grain, you want to make sure they've got all the water they need. So maybe there's savings of 10 or 15% there if you underwater the crop at certain times. Or alfalfa is an interesting crop. It's a perennial crop, kind of like a grass, although it's not a grass. In Colorado, you can actually totally dry up alfalfa if you want. It'll come back. And so if you're water short, maybe you water it less and you get less yield out of it, but you maybe sell that water or put it to some other purpose. We're investigating ways to come up with water by using less in agriculture in ways that tries not to harm ag.
I can see how that can work if you're very closely monitoring your crop.
Yeah.
I mean, is this one of the areas where satellite monitoring or drone monitoring, you know, to take different frequency photographs, infrared or whatever, to see
in theory,
is there a
yes.
water deficit that's doing harm? Or are we still on the right side of the deficit, so to speak?
In theory, yes. And, you know, something that's also super useful and, frankly, not much used is like soil moisture monitors in fields. You really want to know what soil,
right.
what amount of water is in that soil profile. And, frankly, a lot of farmers don't utilize that kind of information. You'd think they would, but it's expensive, historically been a little bit expensive, and we didn't quite have the technology yet. Today we got it. I mean, we've got phones and the ability to transmit information around very easily.
Right. So, I mean, farming is, in fact, becoming more and more technology. I remember in school when I was about 9 and 10 learning about farming activities in North America, contour plowing. I mean, we had to write essays on contour plowing, you know. Now it just seems so silly not to have done it in the first place. You know, why plow straight up a hill and straight down a hill when you can do it concentrically? But we've come a long way. We know a lot now.
We have come a very long ways. And, you know, when we were growing up, the whole idea of green revolution, right, the enormous increase in yields that happened in the first part of the 20th century, most people kind of forgotten that I would argue the original technological revolution, one of the most important ones in the 20th century was the ability to utilize machines, to utilize crop genetics, to utilize herbicides and fertilizers to actually produce more. And in many cases, yields went up 4 and 5 times. Just, in, you know, from 1900 to 1950, amazing things went on in agriculture. And there's almost a second revolution going on now with regard to this computerization with GPS, precision application of fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides and even using very specialized cultivars, that is to say versions of crops that are devoted or dedicated to kind of minimize the impacts of drought or maximizing the yield in this kind of condition.
And different geologic and climatic
soils
variations within a very small region.
Absolutely. I mean, it's these new combines and tractors, I mean, they drive themselves in some cases. They know exactly where they are in the field because of GPS. They can pick out the variation in yields over portions of a field because of different soil types and different nutrients and the like. There's another revolution going on out here.
Right.
And, you know, people love to speak disparagingly of farmers, kind of dumb farmers. There are no dumb farmers out there. They're really smart. This is a very technologically advanced effort.
That whole point about the self-driving, I mean, we all know about Google cars,
yep.
and we're all thinking, you know, this is going to be a revolution
yep.
for us. But I never thought about it in terms of agriculture.
And
so this combine harvester can know which part of the field to go to, which to leave alone.
It's a lot simpler, too, then, right? I mean, you don't have any other cars out
there.
You don't have
any
buildings. I mean, you got nothing else. It's not a big deal to do this.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Brad Udall. He is the Senior Water and Climate Research Scientist and Scholar at Colorado State University. And we're talking about water. And there's so much to talk about water for the West, whether it's agriculture, whether it's just consumption, whether it's waste. We'll be back in one moment to continue our conversation.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. While we live with lots of microbes that make us healthier, it turns out we also share our bodies with even more creatures, parasites and vermin.
That may sound disgusting, but they reveal many things about our past. For example, most of us harbor a mite that lives in the hair follicles of our faces.
They're tubular, and you've seen one if you squeeze the greasy plug from a nose pore. Scientists collected mites from the faces of 70 people of different origins and sequenced their mitochondrial DNA.
As ancient humans left Africa, migrated, and became isolated populations, mites co-evolved with them. So the type of mite you carry can help identify your origins, since they remain the same even generations later.
The tapeworms that infest mammals can also show when ancient humans began to eat meat. The assumption was humans acquired tapeworms when they domesticated animals some 12,000 years ago.
But modern humans share the same tapeworms as lions and hyenas. Perhaps humans acquired these parasites long before the domestication of animals, around 5 million years ago, when they ate the same animals as the predators did.
As for when we lost our fur, we can look to the lowly louse. Some 7 million years ago, our human ancestors acquired head lice from chimpanzees, and 4 million years later, pubic lice from gorillas. This suggests the hair of the head and groin were no longer connected, allowing for separate environments.
So the multitude of organisms that live on us and in us are not only keeping us healthy, they tell us about our origins, our travels, and our story.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Brad Udall from Colorado State University, and we've been talking about water and the highly mechanized and very sophisticated farming procedures that are now utilizing all sorts of technology, whether it's drones, as we've heard on a previous Science Studio, or whether it's satellite imagery. They know in a field where the variations are, even to that small extent. But let's stay on that topic a little bit, because I learned something a few days ago that I didn't really understand. That if I've got a farm up the Mesilla Valley here or the Rio Grande, and I'm going to grow pecans, for example, or cotton or pecans, I don't know how you pronounce it, that water doesn't cost me anything. It comes from the river. And yet, you know, when I go home and have a shower, I pay for that water from my shower. What's the history there? And what's the correctness about it, if there is one?
So the West has this funny, odd history on water, and it comes from miners. Our water law comes from miners. You know, miners had this idea on mining claims that first in time meant first in right. You know, if you got there first and found the gold, you could carve out a piece of land and call it yours, and the federal government recognized that. And we now have a whole series of laws around that. Well, the miners also needed water, and so they applied that same kind of idea to water resources in the West. First in time means first in right. And water is an unusual substance, right, because it flows. It's hard to actually physically own it because it moves around. And it has aspects of what economists call public goods, meaning that it benefits everybody, right? And so it's hard to imagine that you actually can own water because it benefits the fish and the environment and birds, and it's critical to life. It's important for growing crops. So we have generated this funny system in the West that's now under state law called System of Prior Appropriation.
Is that federal law?
No, it's state law,
actually. So
it's
mainly in the West.
It's the 17 Western states. Most of them have versions of first in time, first in right. The Eastern states have their whole set of other law based on England, right, where it was called riparian water. If you lived on the edge of a water body, you had the right to use it. But if you didn't live on the edge of it, you had no right to use it.
Yeah, so the water, subterranean water, would be for the common good.
So, yeah, so subterranean water, groundwater, is under a whole other set of funny laws, and they vary from state to state. Texas has what's called the rule of capture, and that term actually comes from animals, believe it or not. The idea that if an animal crossed your property, you had the right to capture it. In Texas, if you have land overlying an aquifer, you can go drill into it and capture it, if you will,
yeah,
and not respect anybody else's. It's a race to the bottom, is what it is. In more ways than one.
As a kid, we used to go around what's called scrumping, stealing apples, you know, but only from trees where it was overhanging the fence.
Right.
So that we felt that the right of capture was totally appropriate. The owner of the apple trees or pear trees didn't always agree, but
you know, and just until last year, California had this same crazy system in place, despite the fact that we now know through science that many groundwater aquifers are actually connected hydrologically to a surface stream nearby. And so if you pump water out of the aquifer, you actually affect the stream. And so in places in the West where we had what we thought were two separate systems of law, one for groundwater, rule of capture, if you will, and one for surface water, first in time, first in right, they were meeting head on, because what happened, you'd run out of surface water – to appropriate, first in time, there would be no more water to utilize out of the stream. And so people would then start pumping groundwater, at which point, after a few years, the people on the with surface rights would go, where's my water? It's disappearing. You groundwater users are taking it.
So California is changing its law in this respect?
Oh, yeah. In 2015, for the first time, they actually now have a new groundwater law in place that acknowledges many of these hydrologic science-based realities that we've known about for years, but nobody has ever been able to get into law.
Was that contentious?
It was.
I mean, I would imagine.
It was contentious, but frankly, you know, crisis breeds all kinds of opportunities and realities. And so they've been in the midst of an unprecedented drought that has a climate change component to it. And it was this drought that caused them to realize we have got to deal with this.
The Rio Grande. Let's talk about the Rio Grande.
Yeah.
It's not grande in the slightest. When I came here, I was extraordinarily disappointed.
Rio Pequeno, is what some people say.
Rio Escondido would be a better way to think about this. But tell me about what you see for the future. Changes in the law, if any, for our region, because this is going to be very contentious.
Yeah, and this is the truth of water in the West. You know, you can't live without it. And oftentimes it's perceived to be a zero-sum game. There are ways to make it less than a zero-sum game. Can we change water law? Slowly. You know, the story I love to tell is in my state recently, we had a big battle because people wanted to install rain barrels on their houses to water their gardens. It seems like a logical way to conserve water, use water efficiently. But the people that own the surface water rights said, if you do that, you're stealing our water, that water that falls on your house that you capture would otherwise end up in a stream and would get to us in a matter of days, and you're taking our water. Well, at Colorado State and others, we proved that this really isn't the case. Houses have these impermeable roofs on them. They generate more runoff than they would have generated historically. Why can't we do this? But it took 2 years. It took articles in the New York Times. It took Colorado being a laughingstock for us to realize this is actually a good thing to do and really won't harm people.
Right.
We will change water law, but it will change very slowly. In my state, 200,000 water right holders who have property rights. These are like owning a house, frankly. I mean, you get a decree, you can sell it, you can move it. You don't pay any taxes on it. It's different than a normal property right. That's a good deal if you own a water right.
But going back to the river and the farmer, going back to my farm here on the Rio Grande, and I can just take out as much of the Rio Grande water, or am I limited to a certain
amount?
You're
limited, you know,
historically?
Under water rights, you're limited to the type of use, the place of use, the amount of use. So if you get a court decree that says, okay, you can use so much water, here's your diversion point, you can use it for agriculture, you can use it during these months, and you need to kind of follow these conditions in order to utilize that water right. And then there'll be somebody behind you who has a more – what we call more junior water right. In the Mesilla Valley, all this falls under – this is one of the earlier big projects in the West that the Bureau of Reclamation, the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, built the facilities for. 1905 project reclamation was – put in place in 1902, so very early on. In fact, they had to change the law because Texas was not originally covered by the 1902 law, and so they had to broaden it in I think 1905 to make this project here up in the Mesilla Valley.
So in this case, it's historical. First come, first served.
First served.
And so, but why don't they pay for it? That's the question that I have.
Well, if they had to pay, most of these farmers would go out of business. I mean, that's one of the realities.
And some people
would
say,
how much would they pay?
Right.
You know, let me phrase your water use at your house in a different light, so maybe you understand. There's a woman who ran the Las Vegas Water Authority for years, very colorful, very powerful, did wonderful things. Her name was Pat Mulroy, and her constituents used to come to her and say, you know, water should be free. This is a right. It should be free. And she had this great response one day, and she said, water is free. Here's your bucket. There's Lake Mead. Go have at it.
Right.
And in so doing, she put in context what these water utilities do, right? In her case, they pump water out of Lake Mead 1,000 feet up into Las Vegas. They have piping and plumbing. They treat the water. They treat the wastewater. So in many cases, what you're paying as a municipal user isn't so much for the water itself, but all the infrastructure that's behind.
One understands that.
And that's kind of what goes on with the ag users, right? They pay a little bit, but they're paying for infrastructure. They pay their conservancy district.
Is it going to change?
No, that will not change.
We won't even talk about it. Well, the other thing that I'm intrigued about is that there are little communities down on I-10 east of here. Mm-hmm. A junction comes to mind, Fort Stockton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've got nice underground aquifers. And yet all of a sudden, you know, water is becoming scarce. The drought in Texas, just like the rest of the country in the West. And so rich people from a long way away, you know, mainly from the north, come on down and buy acres, thousands of acres. And now they've got the rights to the water. And then they can sell it, or they can transport it to a market where they can get more money for it. This just seems socially disruptive to me.
Yeah, and I think in many cases it is, and in lots of places I think it's acknowledged to be so. Again, I continue to refer Colorado just because I'm so familiar with it. I know other states, but you know, we have in our state an anti-speculation doctrine associated with our water rights, so you can't come in and buy a bunch of water with the idea that you're going to sell it later without identifying a user. And that doctrine is both good and bad, I would argue. It prevents these speculative money-raising ideas. It also, in some cases, prevents bigger, more unified kind of approaches to solving water problems where you might not have all the dots lined, okay, all the I's dotted and T's crossed.
That's an interesting idea. We've just got a few minutes left. Tell me what you see as the future for the West and water. Is it a total disaster looking us in the – because of climate change, the warming up, the less snow, the more rain, but the more rain means it'll run away?
So I like to say climate change is water change, and you've identified many of the big issues with climate change and water. The biggest impacts on climate change in the American West are right on water, and nobody should be surprised about this. The water cycle actually moves energy around. Climate change effectively changes energy on the planet, where that energy falls, how much it is. The water cycle is going to change. And most of the impacts of the American West are bad and Southwest. Perhaps the good news is that, yeah, we'll end up with less water, but we'll still have enough if we're smart about how we use it. I mean, you might see 20 and 30% declines in water availability in the American West, which is huge. And ag is going to have to adjust because ag's 80% of water use. Cities are going to have to adjust. We're all going to have to conserve.
Orange groves, for example, in Yuma, Arizona. When I first saw that, I thought, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's clever engineering, clever agriculture. But that, you see that disappearing, like pecan farms in the Rio Grande. 30 gallons of water for a nut or something
like
that? Yeah,
some of this is going to change for sure. And that's one of the weird artifacts of water law, right? In that the original users of water in the American West have the most senior water rights. That's agriculture. Yet the most highly valued users are in our municipalities, right? I mean, it's just the modern world. And you're not going to deny these municipalities the water they need to grow. It just, it's not going to happen politically.
We've got to wrap it up. But one thing I remember now about Boulder, there was a time when they said we were going to not allow any more people to move into Boulder. Mm-hmm. Is this a future of the West? I mean, if we're going to be limited to water, we can't allow unlimited immigration.
Wow. You said it. I didn't. You're not going to say no. I think we're going to get super clever with water. I think there's still a fair bit of flexibility and waste in the system to tap right now.
Okay.
So that's probably our buffer in the short term.
Okay. Well, this has been great. And we're vanishing. We've finished our allotted time on Science Studio. Brad Udall, Colorado State University, scientist and scholar. It's been a great pleasure having you here.
Keith, thanks. It's been fun.
And Norma, thank you. Norma Martinez, that is. Thank you for editing this so elegantly. And we'll be back next week with another program. Bye-bye.